Welcome to the Great Base Tennis Podcast. This is Andy Patel, your co-host, alongside Steve Smith, as always. And this is episode 13. And today we've got a really special guest, Rob Krychek.
Yeah, looking forward to talking to Rob. We're going to talk about tennis parenting. I've known Rob and his wife, Sherry, for 23, 24 years. I met their son, Austin. He was 7 years old.
Yeah, Austin's a current ATP specialist.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get into the results of his junior career and college career and pros. But yeah, he has 8 singles titles, 35 doubles titles, was ranked 94 in the world in singles. 35 is his highest ranking in doubles. He's won over $1 million. He won another ATP title just a few weeks ago. But yeah, let's get Rob on the phone. I think it'll be fun to talk to him.
Yeah. I think really to point out for tennis parents as well is that he's really won at every level, junior, college, and then on to the pros. So as far as from going from one level to the next, Rob will have some insight.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so many different chapters.
Yeah.
A lot of stories.
Breaking into your phone here.
Okay. One ring.
Hi, Steve and Andy.
Rob. Robbie, baby. What's up?
Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, I look forward to talking to you.
Thanks for the time here.
Great.
No, we said a few things as we opened the show up about your son, Austin, and certainly I know the story from maybe not from the first days on the court at age 6, but from age 7. But let's do this. You and your wife are both athletes. I think it'd be good for our listeners to just know a little bit about your background first. And Andy, I can ask you some questions about your background and then with your wife. I won't mention that you have a beautiful wife and you married over your head. I'll just try to stay right on course with the tennis.
Thanks, Steve. I was born and raised in Ohio, literally on a farm, literally milk 75 at a Holstein until I went to college. Played the 3 sports, football, basketball, and baseball. We didn't have swimming or golf or tennis or anything like that. And my favorite sport was basketball, and I actually ended up playing small college basketball, and that's my sports, if you will. Sherry's from Pittsburgh, and Sherry wasn't an athlete in school. She did the drum and bugle corps. I say the band. Sometimes she gets upset with me. It's the drum and bugle corps, and she used to travel around with them, and it was a big thing. But Sherry, actually, when we moved to Florida, she actually became a very good water skier. As a matter of fact, a world champion water skier, a professional water skier at Cypress Gardens. She's a nurse, but that's her path to athletics is through water skiing.
Let me go back to the cows for a minute. What time did you have to get up in the morning to milk those cows?
4:30.
Yeah.
And to this day, I still don't use an alarm clock.
Yeah.
Sometimes I will set one just to be, you know, sure if I have a business meeting or something like that. But I can almost say I've never used an alarm clock. Well, one other sidebar to that, and I think this hopefully will come up later. I never missed a day of school. Mm-hmm. Elementary, you know, kindergarten, elementary, junior high school, college, ever.
Yeah.
Did I ever have a cold? Sure. Yeah. But the cows had to be milked.
Yeah.
And I kind of instilled that in Austin. So he's never missed a tennis match. Yeah, discipline. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
With the 3 sports, back in the day, obviously, you and I'm a little older, maybe a couple months older than you. We went with the seasons back then. But you ended up playing basketball in college, correct? That was the sport you played after
high
school?
That is correct. Yes.
So our listeners, Rob and Austin, I met them in Tampa, and Sherry as well, and got them tickets to a hockey game, and they went to the hockey game. You know where I'm going to go with this. And they thought the intermission between the first and the second period was halftime. They thought it was over after 2 periods. So that's probably the first time I called you a dummy, Krychek. But go ahead.
I've only told 2 people about that experience ever, and now you just told everybody.
One basketball story. There's so many things I could ask, but you became a referee, and I, yeah. You know, our listeners So younger listeners probably wouldn't know Bobby Knight, but Bobby Knight, the very intense, successful basketball coach, University of Indiana.
Very good at throwing chairs.
And, but, and like yourself, I think he's from Ohio, but he, you know, he was a coach and you ejected him from one of the games. Tell us about that.
He's
a referee, I should say.
I was a referee. I officiated college basketball for 17 years.
Wow.
After I moved to Florida, I continued also, but, in Florida, you know, people are fishing and playing tennis and enjoying the outdoors, in Ohio, in Indiana, but I'm from Ohio. You Tuesday, Friday, Saturday night, you play basketball. So I officiated basketball and, a lot of experiences and so forth, but Bobby Knight was, one of my officials that, I did eject from a game. So it wasn't the chair incident, everybody's so familiar with, but it was something very similar to that. Bobby actually is a very nice guy. Bobby Knight does his job. He's an intimidator on the court. That's his job.
Yeah.
Afterwards, he'd actually go out and have a steak and a beer with you. And Bobby's actually a pretty good guy. The bad guy, was Bobby Huggins from WVU, West Virginia University. Worked him at Akron and then at Cincinnati. Now he's back at WVU, and he was a mean guy, and you couldn't get close to him.
Both on and off the court, you mean?
Both on and off the court. You could never get close to him. He's just Bobby Huggins is Bobby Huggins.
With
not giving you many hugs.
I'll ask you a question about Sherry with a water skiing. One time I was a perennial tennis bum of Boca Raton. Tell us about water skiing at the Boca Hotel. Beautiful place.
Yeah, we used to do what we call water ski shows. We were, besides competitive water skiing, you know, slalom, tricks, and jumping, we used to participate in. And Sherry's specialty was show skiing. And we used to do pay shows. We'd open up convention centers and housing developments and things. And we used to ski, you know, probably a couple times a year at the Boca Hotel, the pink building that Steve is pretty familiar with. And we've talked about it tennis wise. And we used to do water ski shows there. And typically they were at night. And they've got these poles, you know, for all the docks and things like that. We used to have guys standing on the side, shining lights on the poles so we wouldn't hit them, you know, building pyramids and barefooting and stuff. So water skiing was, we did that for 15 or so years. And it's part of our life for sure.
With, I remember that on the Intercoastal. I remember those waters well with,
right.
But Sherry being a school nurse, I remember asking her, tell me a story, because so many kids would come to her with a stomach ache. And so you never miss a day of school, but her job for years and years was kids who wanted to go home because they had a stomach ache.
Exactly. Sherry actually was a nurse for 32 years. She's retired twice. And she started out, she's a scrub nurse. She scrubbed for open heart surgeons and then worked in doctor's offices. And then when Austin started in school, we didn't have Austin until later. I was actually 35 and she was 33, going to be 34. And she was a school nurse for the last 25 years. And, the school nurse is, you know, you don't see the good kids. As somebody said, well, you probably know Johnny and Susie, my kids that are in school. But if Johnny and Susie were the good kids, typically, you know, you didn't see them. You saw the kids that wanted to get out of class. And yeah. Sometimes they were sick. Most times they weren't. But there's so many stories. But the good thing about that is that, you know, she may be a carrier of everything, but she was immune. And because she was immune, I was immune. And because I was immune, Austin was immune. So it probably worked out for the best.
With we haven't had a session on personality typing, brain typing, but we're going to do that. Mm-hmm. Actually, with husband and wife, out of the from the Myers-Briggs, the personality test, the mother and daughter put it together in the 50s, there's four categories. And it, usually husbands and wives are three out of the four, the opposite. Opposites attract. But now I have you down as the supervisor, the planner, one of those two, and Sherry as a friendly facilitator. But when it comes down to the two of you, I mean, obviously you did a great job. I mean, I go to the other extreme when we talk about Austin, is that it's almost like you did two. We'll talk about Austin. It's almost like you did too good of a job, because I used to always say to Austin, he was just too nice. We could talk about all the different examples, but with Tell us a little bit about the two of you start playing tennis. How did Austin first pick a racket up?
Well, in college, you can't, play basketball year round, and quite honestly, you can't drink beer all day, whatever. Well, it's easy to drink beer at night and things like that. But
really?
So I played tennis, just pickup tennis. Never had a lesson in my life, but being a pretty decent athlete, I was able to play and not embarrass myself too much. But I didn't know grips. I didn't know. I just was pretty athletic and fast or whatever. So I enjoyed it immensely. Mm-hmm. When we had Austin, when he was 2 weeks shy of being five, I was actually playing a USTA league, a 4-0 league, and I set my racket down and went into, I'm not sure if it was on a break or the match was over, but I came out and Austin had picked up my racket and he said, "Dad, can I try?" Now, of course, I had a full size racket and he's not 5 years old yet, so I said, "Well, sure." And that's honest God truth. And he's never set the racket down since. We've never had to ask him to want to go to play. Matter of fact, we'd have to cut him off. Mm. An interesting story. Steve Denton, Coach Denton at A&M, we would talk about stories like this also. And Austin is just a good kid, but he's pretty excitable and what have you. And I said, to try to control all the different things, whatever else. And Steve Denton asked me a question. He said, "Have you ever tried to blow out a flare?" And I go, "No." He says, "Well, you can't, and don't try." That's his spirit. So not a bad spirit, but that's just his spirit. He wanted to play. We'd have to cut him off, 10 more balls. Only five more, Dad.
Yeah.
So he always wanted to play.
I always remember that, like with Wayne Bryan, with the Bryan brothers, that he would cut them off right as they're kind of at their peak of enjoyment. Like if they were playing for an hour and they're really having a good time, he'd be like, "Okay, we're done for the day," just to keep that.
Actually, when Jimmy Connors' his mother, Gloria, passed away, I read so much about her, and that's something I didn't know. We both consider ourselves lifetime learners in tennis, but she would do the same thing, and kids would be all pumped up and say, "Okay," or Jimmy would be pumped up, like, "Okay, we got to stop now."
Yeah.
I'm a pretty big reader, and I read, give them a little bit less than what they want. Exactly. So yeah. We would try to cut him off, but he always wanted to play more. But, you have to control it somewhat.
Yeah.
With, so your wife's a nurse, you've made your living in the insurance business, but before I met you, your son was already, and again, I met him at seven, but so your son was already rolling in tennis but you made a point to go to all the clubs in greater Tampa, St. Pete. And I know that I met you through, Thomas Olestad, and that Austin was born in June of 1990. He had already qualified for the Little Mo, and then we made a videotape. And so after the Little Mo, why don't you touch upon that? He had to make all these changes in his game, grips and swings and that type of thing.
Well, when Austin, again, was five or so, we started taking him to lessons. And I was just hitting with it basically to start with. But probably when he's five and a half, we went to Brandon Swim and Tennis Club where we lived, and Pete Stecker was there, and a pretty good coach. But after about 6 months of hitting hits and giggles, he pretty much told me, and I thank him for this. He said, "Rob, I can't take him any further. You need to find somebody else who can take him where he's going to go." Hmm. And I thought that was a lot of insight or foresight, if you will. So what I basically did is I kind of scouted around reading and so forth. And I ran into a fellow who had a magazine in Tampa, K-Swiss Magazine. His name was Scott Nunn. And we became friends, and I actually sold him insurance. And he said, "Well, why don't you come work for me kind of part-time? And a good way to meet all the coaches is maybe you go around and sell them advertising in my magazine." So, it didn't hurt to make a little bit extra money, but I got to meet just about everybody. And Tomas Olestad at Carrollwood Country Club at the time, met him. He's a nice guy. He and Monique were just great people. And they said, "Well, what you really need to do is to be videotaped. Let Austin be videotaped." And I didn't understand why, but I didn't question. He seemed like a pretty nice guy and pretty straightforward. So we took a video, and about a week later, he said he would call us and he would analyze it for us. So we came back, and on the analyzation, it was somebody else's voice. We didn't know who the heck is this guy. And we found out it was Steve Smith. And he was in, I'm not sure if you were at that time in Ontario or you're in Michigan, but you were up north somewhere.
Yeah.
And he said, coincidentally, Steve is going to be moving down soon and may want to try to, you know, hook you up with Steve. And that's how it all started.
Yeah, no, we would have that video on file. In fact, we have a course, Tennis Intelligence Applied, and I believe we show Austin at age 8 and at age 18.
Yeah.
And we go through the number of hours that he put in the game. And but I think that the parents need to know sometimes you have to go backwards to go forwards. Yeah. With
Hey, Rob, did Austin play other sports as well? That may be jumping ahead a little bit, but from a young age.
That's a great question, Andy. Thanks for asking that. He did. And we never forced him to play tennis. We did. We took him to baseball. We took him to soccer and basketball. And the only thing that I forced on him was I forced him to play one season of basketball. And he was 9 or 10 or something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, he didn't know that I had played college basketball or, you know, we had a hoop in the driveway or so forth, but he didn't know. So I asked him to, and he played a season of basketball and he'd kill me. Hopefully, I must say, I hope he doesn't hear this podcast, but he was terrible.
I'll send it to him.
Yeah. He didn't have, you know, good positioning, guarding position, blocking out. He didn't know anything about anything. But he tried and he worked really, really hard. And I'm glad that we did that, but he would always come home and say, Dad, when are we going to play tennis? Mm. You know, so tennis was his love and still is.
Yeah. Maybe that helped him a comparative experience, you know?
I think so. Another little thing, is he good at other sports? Absolutely. We'd play baseball actually we'd hit with tennis balls in the backyard and we had an acre or so and, he would hit the balls over the fence. You know, I said, Austin, come on, you know, keep them inside, just hit base hits, not home runs. Mm. Another thing, this is kind of interesting. I'm a righty and I had a right-handed baseball glove and hit right-handed and whatever else. So Austin was doing that also. Mm. So somehow, some way he said, Dad, can I try lefty? Mm. And we found out that he actually is left-handed. And that was kind of good because he actually was serving right-handed when he first started. He was playing as a righty and he switched to a lefty, but he could serve righty or lefty. And we, you know, kind of contemplated that. I know one of the Jensen brothers can do that. And, and Austin probably could too, but we thought it was a good decision, just like a lefty pitcher, a lefty tennis player.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of a minority, but now it's, you know, like 50-50, I think.
So you couldn't tell early on if he was stronger on the right hand or the left hand as far as throwing goes?
Couldn't really tell because he could throw the ball right-handed. He plays golf to this day righty.
Right-handed, yeah.
And he does a lot of things righty still. But he's a lefty and actually can throw a football as well righty as lefty right now.
You know, one thing to touch upon, the backboard, the portable backboard. And Rob and I, Andy, we can talk about it, our listeners on several different levels. But the beginning was, it was called in this country, the tennis mate. In Sweden, it was called the tennis partner. And so by no means, you know, we tell people that we're the mastermind of the great base backboard, but they stopped producing it. But when I met you and Sherry in Austin, I made it mandatory for young kids to buy a backboard. So Austin had what was called the tennis mate, which is basically the same thing as a great base backboard. Yeah. So, I know with your organizational skills, parents should just know that, you know, Rob took tennis to the garage, you know, when it comes down to swinging a sock or hitting off the cone. And of course, you know, Austin was so young. We tell people that, you know, someone that young, 7, 8 years old, they don't really remember that. It's like with Roger Federer, you know, if you want to find out how he played when he was a young kid, you have to ask his mother who said that his lessons were, and I say it all the time, it's a quote, they were 1 hour long. He stood in one place on balance with long follow throughs.
No, I believe that he was taught lag, pull it, snap it, roll it.
The modern game.
at first, and then, you know, Steve taught him, you know, it's a lifting game. And the tennis made at that time and the portable tennis partner afterwards. And Steve May asked me about that later. We actually kind of worked with Steve and kind of took over that business for a short while.
Yeah.
But I still have a tennis made. I looked at it yesterday, as a matter of fact, a green tennis made, and we've got the, it was a portable tennis partner. Now it's a Great Base backboard. They were all the same and they all work equally well, but you know, hitting on that 15 minutes is like hitting an hour is my understanding. And it's a lifting game. One thing I like to say, whatever, it's kind of like, you know, there's those aha moments. We were somewhere, Austin does play golf. Austin could probably be a professional golf player. He picked that up now, you know, that he's a tennis pro. But what basically happened is I remember, I was trying to explain to him keeping your racket on the ball for a longer period of time. I don't know if it was 6 balls or 8 balls, Steve, whatever you taught, but I was trying to teach him to do that instead of hitting it and the ball comes off real quickly. How he learned that is we were playing golf and just putt-putt golf type of thing. We weren't playing golf, putt-putt golf. And to hit the hole, you had to keep the golf ball on the club for a longer period of time, hit it straight. You couldn't come around it or go, you know, sideways or slice it. You had to hit it. And that's how he learned how to keep the ball in the racket. The same thing with topspin. I remember the day that he learned topspin. And those are, in the tennis world, those are big days.
Well, yeah. You being a basketball player, obviously, player then referee, that standstill shot from the foul line, you know, it's just fundamental. The players, they square their shoulders out. I mean, this is their stance and the palm goes towards their target. I think that really helps a young kid out when they're in the driveway just shooting baskets. They know if it goes in the basket, they probably did something right. It's not luck all the time. But when kids hit a regular backboard, they don't get the feedback. A regular backboard initially can be the worst way to practice. Once you have strokes, a regular backboard is, you know, arguably the best way to practice as far as repetition is concerned.
Absolutely. He would challenge himself. He's always wanted to win. I think he's a little bit OCD, to be honest with you. He'd have to have his math problems. He would be on the 24th, 25th math problem and he would make a mistake and, you know, I'd try to erase it for him or help him or whatever else. He'd tear the whole paper up. He wanted to be perfect. He had to win at all games. He would challenge himself and I would challenge him on the tennis mates at the time, you know, to hit 100 balls in a row and then 1,000 balls in a row. And he's, you know, there's a saying that you say, Steve, and I probably won't say it now, but repetition is the mother of consistency. Is that what you say?
Mother of skill. Repetition is mother of skill.
Yeah. Okay. There's a lot of sayings of that. And one of the sayings, I mean, we know all the, you know, red, yellow, green, light points, if you will, and percentage posts and what have you. But the one thing that, I remember more than anything is there's no substitute for a good beginning. Austin was an okay player. He, you know, qualified for Little Mo and what have you. And he was just a good athlete. He was a, you know, fast kid and listened and knew how to play. And he was actually coming in some, not as much as what Steve had him, but, you know, it's just consistency of actually doing that, over and over and over.
Yeah.
With, you know, the progression, you know, so jump ahead. I mean, you obviously continue to progress. You know, I touch upon our listeners, and really our podcast, Rob, you know, is not really a magazine where we just interview different people. But if people listen to our first podcast and our second podcast, they'll just realize there's a connection from one person to the next. But we have this course, How to Practice at Home, and it's all the work in the garage, but Austin did all those things. So he did the program plus. And I think a lot of it had to do with you and Sherry being so supportive, you with your organizational skills, both with understanding of what it takes to perform in sports. But that really, really helped. So I don't want to jump ahead too fast, but he did, I think, by the age of 13, he was at Nick Vallatieri's, correct?
That's correct.
And Nick's... people have called it the toughest playground in tennis. I do think that I think of Austin being a Vallatieri's is a little bit more like a European kid because you and your wife were only an hour up the road, correct? So he could go home on the weekends.
Right.
Why don't you say a few things about the initial experiences at Nick's?
Well, initially, we hated Bollettieri Tennis Academy before he went there, because it was all the foreign kids and, you know, bigger, stronger, whatever. But it is the toughest playing area. But when he got a scholarship to go there, and, you know, we thought it would take the financial burden off of us some, because we were spending quite a bit of money, you know, to go to tournaments, and he was playing, you know, regional things and traveling and flying and what have you. So it was great when he went, but we actually ended up finding out that going there was as or maybe even more expensive, because then we had to fly a coach and pay for the coach's food and all his expenses also. But Gabe, at the time, Nick's, I would say, right-hand guy, a European fellow. I don't even remember his last name, but
Gabe, actually, he's from Colombia. Colombia. Gabe Hermilio. I worked with him with All American Sports back when we were both in our early 20s. But go ahead.
Yeah. Good guy. And he said, and we kind of trained Austin this way, you know, pretty much to be the first one on the court. If practice starts at 8 o'clock, you know, you're there at 7:15, 7:30 and warming up straight, that you're ready to go. You got a sweat going at 8 o'clock. And Gabe had kind of pulled us to the side along with Nick. And he said, Austin was always the first one, you know, there and the last one to leave. And we're real, you know, proud of that.
Oh, that has followed him everywhere he goes. There's so many stories about his work ethic.
I think that goes back to the cows.
The cows getting up early in the morning.
Getting up early in the morning.
close connection between getting up in the morning, getting up in the world.
Yeah.
But
absolutely,
for our listeners, it's changed. You know, some good things come to an end. Back in the day when Austin was born in 1990. My son Connor was born in 1990. Connor is 6 months younger than my son Mikhail is a year older. So we have our critics, as you know, Rob, on how we teach tennis. And I told a person one time, he said, well, yeah, we're definitely doing something wrong, but here's one thought that there's a plus to it and a minus, is that there was three kids from Tampa. It was Austin, Riley DeHart, my son Connor. And Austin's still in the loop where I could see that. We could talk about him eventually playing for the Davis Cup. But all three of those boys, Austin, Connor, Riley, were at least good enough to be practice partners for the Davis Cup team. But on the weekends, you used to go, we would be at a tournament, and parents need to know, it's in junior tennis, it's not like, oh, it's a soccer game, it starts at 2 and you're done at 4:30. You know, you're there on Friday, you're there on Saturday, Sunday, there's rain delays, there's doubles, and it's all weekend. But there used to be those two big yellow school buses. Bollettieri's, they don't do that anymore. They have in-house tournaments. So it used to really be beneficial for us, because we would train all week long, and then on the weekend we could play kids not only from Bollettieri's but from Saddlebrook. They would have a small Mercedes bus, but there would be two, sometimes two large school buses with Bollettieri kids. But you know, I do think one thing, that the Bollettieri system where you work hard, you drill in the morning and you play matches and then you get to move up a court. You know, what's said in tennis is the number one reason for cheating is too much pressure from parents. But also too, I think the toughest playground in tennis, a lot of the kids there, you know, there's a little bit, A few bad calls would be made on the weekend. Not to categorize all kids from one academy, but you know, they were, you know, most of them they were there without their parents, and it was kind of like the tennis jungle. Who's going to survive?
Well, it's kind of like Steve, you know, survive and play well, or come home and pound salt. I mean, literally. A little bit of story of that. Austin was at a junior tournament at Bollettieri. I don't believe I was there. I was probably selling insurance, but Steve was there, and then probably not with Austin at the time, but Steve, you know, would watch his players and was always there for Austin. And he was playing this Russian kid, won't mention any names, just a slang name, Griggy. And during the match or at a changeover or something, Steve said, he called Austin over and says, that kid's hooking you or, you know, cheating you badly, go get an official. So I'm not sure whether Austin did or whether Steve said he did.
No, he did. I'll add to that story. Is Griggy. You know, so Then they were later teammates at A&M.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, I just laid on the table. I mean, I can see in world politics where diplomacy is very important, but in trying to get a kid to be a better tennis player, I think diplomacy can kill time. But so Austin, I wasn't his coach. I coached him for several years. And then even, you know, when he was in college or in pros, I've coached him. But some of that time when he was at Ball Terriers, I coached him incognito. You know, he'd come and do some video work because, I mean, he was a scholarship player at Ball Terriers. So it was a little bit out of place for me to finally go up and go, Austin, get over here and go get an umpire. But yeah, he was on the other end of that. I think that you know, he would be the one who, you know, the ball would be 3 inches out and he'd play it. I tell kids all the time, though, that if you're going to be really good, you're not going to be calling lines. There's going to be lines people.
Yeah.
And then the kids throughout their junior career, the 10s, the 12s, the 14s, the kids who call it really tight, that's going to come back to haunt them because when they, you know, cheated half dozen times, you know, 6-10 times a match on close calls, anything close is out, and they do get to the point where they're good enough to play even at the futures level, they're not calling their own lines.
Rob, I've witnessed, you know, at lots of junior tournaments, especially where, you know, parents get really involved when it comes to line calls. I know Steve went and said, hey, you know, maybe it's time to get a line judge after it repeated so many times. But what would your advice be for parents come tournament time? What would your advice be? How involved or what kind of role should they play?
Well,
maybe you could talk about your own experience.
How I kind of started this interview, if you will, is that don't be a helicopter parent. So yeah. I got out of coaching. Austin could beat me when he was 9, which is great. Mm-hmm. And I don't coach him, whatever else. But again, we went to all the tournaments, or his mother did, you know, especially she traveled all summer long with him and mm-hmm. what have you. But no, for Steve or somebody, one of the parents, hey, go get a line official. Austin lost the matches and got the most, there's a terminology of a trophy that you get, a sportsmanship trophy.
Sportsmanship award, yeah.
And he's got a sportsmanship trophy. He's playing one of his nemesis, Ryan Harrison, out in Palm Springs. We happened to be there, and Austin would not call a ball out. It didn't matter if it was a foot out. He just wouldn't call a ball out. and it was competed, but Ryan did win. But he won the sportsmanship trophy. And I go, Austin, the goal is not to win sportsmanship trophy. You have to, you know, you have to say something. And he does a lot better now. But he's just, if there's a fault with Austin, and it's not a fault, and, you know, maybe the way he was raised, he's too nice. Mm. He's too nice. And that goes with calling, you know, call balls out or getting into arguments and things. I don't think Austin's ever been in a, Steve used to laugh. Austin's never been in an argument where, you know, there's yelling going on or swearing at each other, or definitely not in a fist fight. You know, he holds his own. He holds his own.
No, he's done great. I think when it comes down to it, that's an understatement, but, his junior career, obviously, in American tennis, for people listening overseas, is Kalamazoo, small city in Michigan, a beautiful private college, Kalamazoo College. I mean, they run it, the kids feel like they're at the U.S. Open, but I was at the tournament the year he won, and then also certainly appreciate you could invite a guest, so I went to the U.S. Open with you and Austin. He, by winning the tournament, you win a wild card, but you know, there's so many steps to get to the point where you win your national championship in the 18s. I think one thing to share with the listeners, not only did you do what we recommended in the garage from a tennis standpoint, and we didn't have to tell you to do this, but we do tell parents to make the classroom a car. Why don't you talk about how you used to do that with motivational tapes and.
Absolutely. Things like, you know, motivational tapes. We're big on books. Malcolm Gladwell, The Outliers, you know, 10,000 Hours and, you know, Vic Braden's books and things. We were both students of the books and motivational tapes and things like that. But I feel it's very strong to be always, always positive. You know, things like, you know, sometimes it's kind of blowing a little bit of smoke, but like, you know, someone has to be number one in the world. Why not you? Mm. you know, and you keep working hard, keep working hard, Austin, you'll be able to go whatever college on scholarship that you want to go to. Versus, and I've seen parents, you know, say this or heard this in person and also TV and movies and things, you know, you keep doing that and you're going to end up in jail. So kids are, they're like sponges. They hear you and you're positive and say, yeah, I mean, why couldn't I be number one? Now, Austin may not and probably will never be number one in the world, but you never know. You never say never.
Yeah.
So I think those positive thoughts are very important. And, you know, being well-read, Vic Braden, we had the honor of meeting Vic at the Star or something in Orlando, I think.
Yeah, I remember. You met him a couple times. We went up there and you worked on your game a little. You worked on his game.
Yeah, no.
Vic, it took quite a Vic few people to see Vic.
Vic was great. I didn't know him that well, but we met him and he makes you laugh and it makes you have fun. That was important. Fun.
Here's something for me as a tennis parent. I can remember my son Connor asking me, "Steve, why don't you get free clothes?" And I said, "I've got so many free clothes over the years." But I said, "Now, if I was endorsed by such and such company, I'd have to make presentations courtesy of Nike,
right,
and such and such." And I said, "You know, when I go into a coach's workshop, you know, I'm going to make $2,000-$3,000. And I said, I said, to keep you going, I need cash. I don't need free product. But remember you telling Austin, I also remember when it was Prince the first time. I think it was Pat Connor. Is that her name? Peg Connor. She loved Austin. But I can remember when he was first endorsed by Prince. But before that, you used to tell him, I mean, the parents have to listen. We're talking of kids that are 8, 9 years old, and I call people by their last name. So Krychek is telling his kid, "There's always scouts watching. There's always sponsors watching," which is true. So, I mean, you're really under a microscope, and you need to learn that from the beginning. But Austin, well, he was always professional. I mean, not only the way he acted, but the way he packed his bag and the way he always showed up with, you know, he was ready.
I chuckle about that. There's a reason being. When Austin first started traveling by himself, we tried to get him to pack his own bag, but his mother would help him, and of course put a black shirt with shorts that would match and socks and underwear, and you know, so you kind of pack in an organized way. And the first time we sent him to Texas, coincidentally, where we are right now. He was sent to, I don't even know the name of the place, but it was with Doug Davis. Blake Davis was a junior player, maybe a year or two younger than Austin. And he went to hit with Doug for a week or two and went to a tournament. And Austin had three pieces of luggage. Doug called me up and reprimanded me. He said, "Rob, you don't need that. You know, you need a tennis bag and maybe, you know, one clothes bag or whatever else." And he taught him. It was really interesting. Doug was a great guy. He taught Austin how to wash clothes, how to cook and whatever. I got one other story also. This is independent. And my wife still, you know, does not like this story, but when Austin was, I'm not sure how old he was. I would say 11 or 12, maybe 10. He was traveling himself. We lived in Tampa, lived in Brandon and flew out of Tampa. And when you get to Tampa, the main airport, you have to take a little train or tram to the outer place where the airplanes are. So we'd always get there and then we'd have to get a pass because we weren't flying, a pass to go on the train with him. Then he would get on the plane, have a pass, and then somebody had to meet him when he got off. Well, after a few months or 6 months of that, he had enough of that. So he said, "Dad, I could do it myself," which is great. I mean, I was glad that he did that. So the very first time he flew himself, I didn't go on the tram. I said bye and gave him a hug, gave him a high five and say, "Go get it, you know, do your thing." So I left driving for an insurance appointment, half hour, 45 minutes away, you know, he was there early, and he called up. He says, "Dad, the flight's been canceled." So I kind of thought out loud, like, what should I do for a learning experience here? I said, "Okay, figure it out and call me when you get there."
How old was he then?
He was probably 11, 12, maybe. Nice. Yes. To figure it out. And I told his mother, I told Sherry that. She was so angry at me. but I think those are the type of things that, you know, independence. And now, for sure. Of course, he packed his own, or, you know, shortly after he was packing his own bag. And it's interesting, from the time that he was probably that age, 12 to, through college and maybe even now, he's never really unpacked his bag. Now, realistically, he has, of course, but because he changes bags and to give him new bags and so forth, but he's never really unpacked his bag. I don't think he takes his clothes and his underwear and his socks out and puts them in a drawer. What he does is he'll take them out and wash them and put them back in the bag. He's ready to go. Yeah. And it's just interesting how they think, you know, and you don't think about stuff like that until you see it.
Well, it's so important for kids, the sooner the better, to learn to be independent, learn to be able to travel.
Sure.
You know, Doug Davis, sure. I've only met Doug Davis once or twice. You meet coaches at junior tournaments, but I quote him all the time. I was watching, who's a player also born in 1989, 1990, Ashley Wynald, and I was connected. I trained her parents how to teach tennis. And so she was being coached by Doug. And so, I was watching the first time and then watching her second time. And he says, can I ask you why you're watching my player? And I introduced myself and told him my connection. But so we talked, and it was at the Eddie Herr where there's all the players from all over the world. And he said, Steve, we're standing among the weakest people on the planet, meaning junior tennis kids. But, one thing with Austin with cell phones, so when you said that he called you up, would you remember, or you have to go back, would that have been from a payphone, or did he have a cell phone by then?
Yeah, I don't, he didn't have a cell phone till later. I mean, for a lot of reasons, because you, Steve, he didn't have a laptop for a while. He didn't have a cell phone for a while. As a matter of fact, I'll take a little bit of credit here. I was the person, the reason that Steve finally got a cell phone after about 30 years of coaching. I was around him for a couple of years. I said, Steve, I know why you don't have it, but you need a cell phone. But I think it was from a payphone. I got a little story also. Just talking makes me think about things I haven't thought about in years and years and years. Austin knows Ashley pretty well. When he was, again, 12, 13 years old or so, he was at a tournament by himself. And I think it was in Palm Springs, I think. And he was on a gondola. I'm not sure how you say it, but he was on the thing that went up the mountain that, you snowski on. But they were just kind of taking a ride. So he had called me, and I didn't answer at the time. So he was on a cell phone at that time. And I called him back, and I was kind of talking to him. He says, Dad, I can't talk right now. I said, why can't you talk? He says, I'm on a gondola with a girl. And they were kids, and it was Ashley Wynhold. It was Ashley, yeah.
No, that's a fun story. Tell us about Pete Sampras. Kevin O'Connor set that up, and you went out to Saddlebrook. I had a chance to meet Pete Sampras at a young age.
For sure. I always thought and still think, you being around people like that, be like the leaders, do what they do and see what they do. So I kind of researched it and made a few phone calls, or quite a few phone calls, quite honestly, and ended up with Kevin McCurdy, I believe is his name. And I'm not sure. I think he was Pete Sampras's manager. It wasn't his coach, but I think his manager or something. So he arranged for Austin to come to Saddlebrook to watch Pete Sampras practice session. And he was playing with Christian Rudd's father. Don't remember his first name, but I remember it vividly. And so Sherry and I, we kind of stayed back, 50 feet or so from the fence, sitting in the shade, kind of watching practice and not saying anything. Austin was on the fence, had his fingers through the fence, and he was up there, whatever. And Pete's coach, and I don't recall who that was at the time, to be completely honest with you. But the coach says, Pete, want me to get the kid off the fence? And Pete says, no, Austin's with me. And I go, wow. And that just really impressed Austin. We got pictures still to this day of Pete. Pete's a great guy. And if there's anybody that Austin has tried to mold his game after, and he certainly doesn't play like, Pete or anything like that, but the serve and volley, aspect of it. Pete is his, if you ask him, I'd say Pete would be his favorite player next to Fed.
When it comes down to philosophy, when you spend so much time around someone, it's amazing what you learn. These are a couple of Rob Krychek lines, bits of philosophy that I teach. Don't be an ifer, You know, if I had done this, if I had done that. I always remember you telling people, don't be an ifer.
Well, you know, people make an impression on you. And a high school basketball coach, I guess when I was in the eighth grade or ninth grade or something, our high school team wasn't very good. But when I was a freshman or sophomore, I was on the varsity team. I was pretty tall and for my age and pretty good basketball player at that time. And our coach pulled us into a classroom. I think it was before practice, and we were getting ready for tournament play. And he basically, long story short, said, you know, there's going to be a lot of people in the stands and whatever else, and that have played basketball before you and whatever else. And, you know, it's really up to you. It's up to you guys and to me to actually go out there and do the work. And don't be an ifer. Well, what's being an ifer? Don't be, if I would have tried harder, if I would have thought about it, you know, then, if I knew then what I know now, I would do that. Don't be an ifer. Do it now.
Yeah.
And I've taken that story with me to, you know, every job, every situation, and have implanted that. And Austin can say, tell the story better than I can, but don't be an ifer.
How about the one with, you're a football player, you're carrying the ball and you're just about to get hit by the linebacker. What do you do?
Yeah. There's, a player who's, you know, let's talk about a receiver, a football receiver, you know, the one who catches the ball, if you will. There's a difference between a good player, a good football player, and a great football player. But it relates and corresponds to anything, I think. But a good receiver will, you know, get open, catch the ball, and run, you know, as fast as and far as he can. When it's inevitable he's going to be tackled, he's going to, you know, he's going to find a nice soft spot to fall or land or get hit as, you know, easy as possible. That's a good player. A great player does all those same things, but when it's inevitable he's going to be tackled, he's going to stick the guy and hit the guy who's going to tackle him harder than what he was going to get hit. Mm. That's what it takes to be a great player, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Facing adversity.
No, you've already mentioned one thing that I have in my notes here. I loved how you used to always tell kids that somebody has to make it to the top. And I mean, so many young kids, obviously, they're just in the moment, and they don't realize that it's all developmental, and what you're doing at age 8 is so you can be better at age 9. It's the same progression when you're working on arithmetic and you're going to go to subtraction. But I used to love how you would tell people that. Another one was this, right. you understood jockocracy. In other words, you know, Austin was going to carry his own bag, pack his own bag. And
absolutely.
The work ethic, you mentioned that about Gabe. Our listeners, you know, I started training tennis teachers formally when I was 26 years old, where the students got a 2-year degree. In fact, how I met Rob was through, we mentioned earlier, Thomas Olestad. He was a student in that program where you get a 2-year degree. But when Austin, you know, even before he went to college, I think he had played, you know, 20, 25 futures. But he was always going to tournaments. So, I mean, it got to the point where, you know, certainly it's fun for me. You know, I get a phone call from Rob and say, do you know anybody in, you know, the most southern part of Texas, or do you know anybody in Missouri? Or so Austin did hook up with so many people that I train to teach tennis, because
so many people. It was so good, Steve. And we appreciate that. And I tell you, thank you every time. And I say thank you again. Steve, you know, coaches how to coach. It's kind of a double-double, but he knows people all over the country, all over the world. And, you know, if he's going to stay somewhere, why not stay somewhere where Steve has actually trained that coach? They're talking the same philosophy.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're typically really good people. So now, you know, if they hit with him or so forth, they've got the same mentality and the same philosophy, whatever else. So he's made friends all over the world. Austin went to public school through the fifth grade. And then we thought, you know, to help his tennis, if you will, give him a little bit more time in the court, we ought to homeschool him. So we contemplated, and we didn't know anything about homeschooling. And but we decided in the sixth grade to homeschool. And the fifth grade, Austin was like a crossing guard or something and whatever else. And a police officer came, like when you graduated from the fifth grade, and he said, you know, you've been going to school the same area that all your neighbors, whatever else. Now, when you go into middle school or junior high or whatever they call it, middle school, I guess, it's different schools are going to come together. And those, and it's kind of like when the hormones start raging, whatever else, and it's probably the most dangerous time, whatever. So we thought it was a good time to homeschool. So Sherry took a year off. She was a school nurse at the time, took a year off thinking that she was going to have to teach math and science, and she couldn't sleep at night thinking about that. It wasn't that way. She didn't have to teach at all. It was, you know, something out of California. It's a really good situation. But what basically happens is that, you know, Austin was, you know, in the sixth grade, and he was, you know, still training with Connor McHale, you know, lifelong friends, what have you. But he was beating most of the high school players at the time, you know, some that he wasn't, but some that he was. And so homeschool was really good for Austin, and, you know, gave him good time to train. But if you really think about it, and with this COVID thing, there's a lot of homeschooling going on now. You know, school is actually probably only, you know, 2 or 3 hours of intense work. And then at the rest is recess and study hall and stuff like that. So why not get your work done, you know, every day, and then train for tennis. And that's what we chose to do.
How many hours did Austin train as a kid? A lot of parents and coaches, but a lot of parents will ask how many hours should my kid train during the week or during any given day?
Well, it always cracks me up. I got a good friend, Pink, and his son and daughter. You know, he thinks, you know, spending a couple $100 a month is like a lot of money. And not the Steve, I don't even know what Steve even charges now. Is, you know, 20 years ago that, you know, that we were paying Steve. Not enough. but it's what you do. It's what you do. You have to be around. Yeah. To answer your question, Andy, I mean, you know, like I say, well, you train 2 hours, you train 10 hours, you know, it varied, but he was on the court as much as he can. Mm-hmm. And Sherry, kind of going back to the stories, you know, you think that it's a little bit overwhelming when you're doing it, but it ends up being the best time of your life. She spent a lot of time also listening to tapes, and quite honestly, she would drive him from school, even when he was in elementary school. We were probably an hour and a half away, and Brandon, to where Steve was in Carrollwood, an hour and a half one way through traffic. Mm-hmm. And then I would get off work and she would go home. Then I'd get off work and then I would go be with Steve and listen and learn and, you know, help possibly feed some balls and just listen for Austin's benefit. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, every day. One thing I'd like to say about this and learn from Steve is that, you know, and I won't mention any names, other players, whatever else, but, you know, you have, Thanksgiving break, and you have Christmas break, you have Easter break. Well, they, you know, a lot of parents, a lot of players think that that's a break from tennis also. Mm-hmm. So no. That's the time you can really play tennis. Mm-hmm. You can spend all day, every day there.
Yeah.
And it's just the difference. You can just tell the parents and what have you. This is just something that I had, you know, Steve had asked me to be on this program, and he asked me, you know, maybe some tips and pointers for junior parents and, you know, even college parents, and even pro parents. I don't know. But as a junior, I think there's really three things it takes to develop a good or even a great player. The first thing that it takes is having a player who has the ability and potential and who's willing to train and work hard, who doesn't have to necessarily be the best player, the biggest kid, or the strongest kid, but just somebody who's got the ability and is willing to work.
Yeah.
The second thing is being lucky enough to find or, you know, fall into, as we did, a great coach who knows what they're doing and has the player's best interest in mind. And then the third, and I'm not saying this is the most important, you know, being a player that's willing and has the potential, but this is very important. Having a parent or parents who are willing to do whatever it takes. You know, so we would be there for him, but I stopped being involved, would I warm him up at a tournament when nobody else is there? Sure. Mm-hmm. But I stopped telling him or coaching him or doing anything when he was nine. Mm-hmm. That was Steve's job. That was Omar's job. That was Nick's job.
Yeah, you're a coach's dream. Dream parent.
Yeah. Let's circle back, Rob. I appreciate that. What about Laurel? Was it Laurel Springs? Did Austin do the same curriculum the whole time?
Laurel Springs, yes.
Yeah,
he did Laurel Springs, and it's a great school. Can't say enough about it. And by the way, if there's any parents out there that are considering it, it's a great school, and you don't have to teach anything. You know, you have to be sure that they do their work and, you know, are and so forth, but it's a great school. But he started in the seventh grade and graduated. It's kind of interesting also. There's, you know, just things that I think of when you were talking about things like this. When Austin first was going to be homeschooled, some of the teachers and other tennis parents, and they said, you're making a big mistake. Austin's going to be a social misfit. He's going to, you know, lose, not going to go to the prom. He's not going to go to the malls. He's not going to have girlfriends and things like that. And so we just kind of, you know, we didn't really say anything, but in fact, Austin is probably more worldly and outgoing than any other kid that I know, because he was traveling all the, he's going to go see Hamblin and Squires and Richard Hernandez and Frank Hornig in Canada and people in Vancouver and California. I mean, you know, it's been a great ride, and Austin has friends all over the world. Yeah. So
traveling is an education in itself.
Yeah. And Mark Twain, don't let the classroom interfere with your education.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he would write book reports reports on his travels, and his teachers, you know, like Laurel Springs loved that. And he would write things like observations. He'd be in Australia and notice that when you flush the toilet, it goes the opposite way.
Yeah.
I mean, stuff like that. And yeah, it's crazy. And so he would write reports about things like that. And, you know, it was very interesting to the other students and to the teachers. And he had good marks, and Austin's a sharp kid.
Rob, just quickly, going back to vacations and time off, I spent the last 4 years living in Germany, my wife Sherman, and I was amazed on how serious they take vacation. It was like, once it's time for vacation, like everybody takes off, you know, for 3 weeks or more. But what do you remember as far as his junior days growing up? You know, do you have, okay, hey, we take every Sunday off, or was there scheduled time off?
You know what? Austin never really wanted to have time off. Mm-hmm. Quite honestly, he always wanted to hit. So I'm not saying we hit every day, and I would like, hey, there's one day, you know, Sunday we're going to go to church or we're not going to hit on that day. We'd hit whenever he wants to hit. Not as hard every day, but if he wanted to hit, we'd pretty much hit.
Yeah.
He's very, very fond of, you know, Squires and Hamlin and those guys over there. Mm-hmm. And they do. I think they call it holiday. Maybe they call it vacation, but I think Europeans call it holiday.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, for 2 or 3 weeks or a month or something like that. Mm-hmm. Austin was in Germany on his 16th birthday. And he was with Squires, I think. And, you know, we were like, okay, you know, he's 16 and this guy, and we didn't know David. You know, I mean, he's a nice guy. We'd met him and whatever else. But he came home and he says, Germany's got the best apple juice I've ever tasted.
Yeah, for sure.
And I know, and I thought he was teasing that maybe they were, you know, they let him taste a beer or something like that. Whatever. But no, it's apple juice. And I don't know what it is about Germany, but they have great apple juice. And that's what that's what he remembers. But he loved his time. He loves Germany. If you ask him where else if there'd be someplace else they'd live, it'd probably be Germany. He loves Germany.
I know, my first year over there, it was like Apfelschorle. It was like sparkling apple juice. You just pounded it.
Ich möchte Apfelsaft. With going back on when you said number one is work, you know, I think that also ties in with being low maintenance. You know, Austin was always low maintenance.
Right.
When you know, I think a lot of times as far as schooling is that it's not a matter of socialization, it's a matter of desocializing. But there's that line that I picked up somewhere, you want to go to the prom or you want to go to the pros. But, you know, you do make sacrifices like, well, okay, I'm not doing the everyday thing. The number one sport in America is to go to the mall. Talking about vacations, to digress, Ty Tucker, Ohio State coach, who's another person who called me up, you know, Austin ended up practicing at Ohio State, and he goes, this guy's work ethic, he's organized, he's on time. A mom with two daughters, she's at a tournament, and she corners Richard Williams and his two famous daughters, Venus and Serena. And I mean, there's so many things we could talk about. I know Austin, when he was younger, he was a hitting partner for Serena. So woman says, I love your daughters, Richard. They're our role models. They're great, great, great. And Richard said, do you go on vacations? He said, you know, the woman asked for some advice. And his question to start off giving advice was, do you go on vacations? And she said, yeah, we go on 2 vacations a year. We love it. We bond. We become so much closer as a family. He goes, well, my advice is if you want to be a great tennis player, you never go on vacation.
I thought it was something that could be wrong, but like, hey, well, you should just quit now because you never.
That's good, Andy.
You got to sacrifice.
But when Rob mentioned some of the names, we had Richard Hernandez talking about Canadian tennis with one of Austin's big buddies, Tennis Sangra, and he stayed with some of Richard's friends up in Toronto for tournaments. And our listeners need to know that there is the three-tier system in pros where you play futures, then you play challengers, then you play ATP. So there's obviously a number of smaller tournaments in the greater Toronto area. But yeah, Austin rocked up and David Squire's place. David took him when Austin was playing the Junior French Open. And I remember Squire saying, he just was very polite. He asked me where the gym is and can you set me up for 2 matches a day? And, you know, then I said, hey, just help out coaching the little kids as much as you can. And, let's jump ahead to, college tennis. Steve Denton, Texas A&M. Why don't you start with a few thoughts on his college career?
Well, Austin actually moved out of our house when you said, Steve, when he's 13 or 14, went down to Bollettieri, and we thought that he was just going to play pro tennis. He was actually playing pro tennis, playing futures, you know, at that age. And you know, he wasn't winning a lot, but he was winning some tournaments. And I got to pat myself on the back because if you don't take the money, I'm kind of a financial guy. If you don't take the money and buy cars and stuff like that, you just reimburse your expenses, you're still an amateur. Mm. So Austin, from the age of 14 to about 17, was doing pretty well and getting along real well, playing with all the top players in the world and traveling the world and what have you. But when all the scholarships started coming in between his junior and senior year, he had scholarship offers, full rides from anywhere and everywhere. I mean, Ty Tucker and A&M and Florida and Stanford and USC, UCLA, you know, Virginia, everybody yeah, wanted, well, not bragging, just kind of saying. So yeah. Austin, this is Austin. This is his mature thinking, when he's 17, he's a dad. And the reason being is he's 6'2", 6'3", the lefty, and he was serving, you know, pretty good and playing some pretty good matches, but he only weighed about 155 pounds soaking wet at that time. And he just wasn't big enough and strong enough, and he knew that. So he said, Dad, why don't I take one of these scholarships and go get bigger and stronger, let them pay for it? I'm going, yeah, that sounded pretty good. And start my education. I go, wow, what a mature thing to say. So we kind of helped him narrow it down from, you know, 200 to 50 to 20 to 3. Ohio State, where I'm from, you know, I knew of and knew Ty Tucker, and great guy, great coach, and great program. Dad is too cold. So then he thought about Florida, and he had every blue and orange, everything, dog leashes and blankets and pillows. And he had everything. So we thought he was going to go to Florida, and so did Andy Jackson. So so Andy, you know, came down and interviewed him in Steve's office, actually. And then we had one more, and Austin, he probably would have signed right then on the spot. But we'd committed to one other, he had committed, but we had committed to see one other person. It was Steve Denton from Texas A&M. And Steve was giving us guidance. Steve's been, you know, Austin's mentor and for a lot of part, it still is. He said, Austin, you told Steve Denton that you would talk to him, so you need to talk to him. So we talked to him, and we like Steve. We like his style of play and his background and whatever else. So the first trip that Austin took, Steve Denton invited him and us out to Texas A&M. And they just opened up the doors. I mean, we went to a football game and did all. He just rolled out the red carpet, he and Bobby McKinley. We liked them a lot. So at that time, Austin said, let's go here because of all the things. And he met a good buddy of his, Connor Pollock. He was kind of the host player that was with him, whatever. I said, no, Austin. Andy Jackson, Florida, invited you up, so we need to do our due diligence the way that Steve had said also. So we went up to Florida, and they showed us a pretty good time also, but there was but he decided to go to Texas A&M.
Also, with that, Rob, why don't you touch upon that? Austin went, and he was 17. He was
17.
He had the credits, yeah. So he graduated in January. So when it would have been his spring semester of his senior year, you know, he was playing for Texas A&M. Why don't you talk about that a little
Exactly.
bit?
Exactly. Well, Steve, yeah, when he got there at 17, he couldn't understand why Austin couldn't sign for himself. He was 17, Steve. So he decided to go out there and he played, you know, right away. I think the first match he played, he clinched the match, and we didn't even know what clinching a match was. And everybody's all excited. We're going like, we expect, you know, Sherry and I, we expected him to win, but everybody threw the Gatorade in the water and so forth like that. And he went all 4 years. He started out, believe it or not, I should say, believe it or not, but, Red and Nick down at Military were pretty angry that he started out playing five. And I don't know if that was intentional or strategy on Steve Denton's part or not, but he started at five, and then by the end of the season, he's playing three. And then the next year, I think he played two. And the very first year, he got to the semis of the NCAA doubles tournament. And everybody was all excited. The first time we've been to the semis, and anybody's ever gone there, what else? And we were just kind of disappointed that he didn't win. I said, why didn't you win the tournament? You know, so, and then his senior year, he won two national championships, Steve. One that's a real championship, the one that's a good championship also. He won the indoors with Jeff D'Adamo. Okay. And he also won the NCAAs at Stanford. You haven't asked this question, but let me kind of just say, because I want to be sure everybody hears what I say, and you mentioned he went early. If there's one thing, and I'm not sure that this is Austin's philosophy, but this is a parent talking. If there's one thing I would have changed, I would have guided him. I won't say insisted, but I would have guided him to not go at half year. I would have guided him to go when he's supposed to go in August after his senior year. Here's why. He started, and it was for the team and for Steve. And I have no problem with that. They wanted him there, and he was good enough. Lord knows. But he started playing, and when it became May, and he was done with the NCAAs and done with his spring semester, he is still a freshman academically, but he's a sophomore athletically. So you're a half year behind no matter what. Another thing is that, quite honestly, I don't believe that Austin or I or Steve and the, you know, Texas A&M were, I wish that he would have graduated on time. There are some schools, and I won't mention schools, whatever, I think that we're so glad he went to Texas A&M. Steve and Bobby love him, had lunch with him the other day, and they're great guys. But I told them this at lunch. The only thing that I would have changed is he started in August and he would have graduated on time. Because come his senior year, he's still a half year behind. And when you're a high-end athlete like that, you're not taking as many courses or as many hours as you could have or should have. So he didn't graduate. He is graduating this fall, by the way. He's been taking online courses. I doubt that he's going to walk. He's 30 years old now. But that's one thing that I would have changed.
Good point.
With my connection with Steve Denton, I lived in Tyler, Texas for 10 years, 81-91, and we had a lot of success with young Texas players. Back then, high school was a big deal, and they won high school state championship after state championship. And Steve had respect for that. So Steve ended up hiring a couple of people I trained, but one was Phnom Paul, and Steve's a big, big guy, as you know. And Phnom, you know, maybe came up to his rib cage. And Steve came off the tour. He was teaching near his hometown in Corpus Christi. And, you know, he was saying, well, this is what you do with your elbow on the forehand volley. And this is what you do on your wrist on the forehand ground stroke. And whatever the technical points were, Phnom would just right in front of everybody go, that's wrong. That's wrong. And Steve was, you know, as you know, he's kind of the big teddy bear. So he was very humble, and he hired me to help him learn how to teach tennis. So that was a connection. And I think another thing, Steve's a very big guy, and someone who worked with us for 5 years, Chad Berryhill, he likes Steve. He's a real big guy. And those guys used to laugh, and they'd walk in and they would say, Steve, I remember Steve saying, they're going to think of that we're the football coaches and we're coaching the interior linemen. But
right.
It was a feather in Chad's cap for, you know, a lot of the young coaches that I've trained to work with your son. You know, he's a highly ranked junior, number one in the country. I mean, if you win Kalamazoo, you're obviously right up there, one, two, or three. And you know, it might fluctuate from week to week, but Chad charted lots of matches for your son. If you could touch upon that, I remember you saying that, you know, you would love to have those numbers. You would love to have someone like Chad in your corner as Austin was playing all those years.
Absolutely. I'd almost rather, and Chad's was a good and still is a good friend of mine. We keep in touch with him. And I think that charting matches is so important, as well as videoing. That's what Steve, with you and Chad and, you know, your organization, Andy, now bring to the table. To have somebody that's actually charting, knowing what you know, how many, Steve used to be with Austin and not at a tournament, but we'd come back to practice on Monday after the tournament, and he wouldn't ask, did you win the tournament, whatever else. He would basically say, is in your last match, how many overheads did you hit? Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's strong. I mean, you know, because he's basically gauging is how many times did you come to the net,
yeah,
and how many times did you force an overhead. That's the kind of stuff that you want. Austin, you know, a lot of times, as a younger junior, maybe, you know, 12, 14 and so forth, he was getting passed a lot because he was, you know, serving a volley and coming to the net and, you know, approach shots and doing whatever else, getting passed and getting lobbed quite a bit. So you just keep playing for the future, keep playing for the future. Then when it came to the 16s, you know, he won the Florida State, the 18s at 16, and it all pays off, and it all pays off. And, you know, he was one of, if not the highest recruited, you know, junior to go to college. And like I said, that's why everybody wanted him, but it's a long process. Back to Malcolm Black Gladwell, 10,000 hours. You know, we used to say 1 million balls, and of course there's probably 100 million balls, mm-hmm, in theory, or realistically, but we used to say 1 million balls, and that was always our goal, just hit as many balls as you can.
Yeah. Well, the thought of having Austin go to not only be with Steve Denton, but Bobby McKinley. You know, Bobby's right, top 50 player in the world. I mean, his brother played Wimbledon. The first time he played it, he won it in 1963, I think. But, instant hostility, you know, I think that obviously you know, playing football and basketball, baseball, there's a lot of sports where there's instant hostility. Nick Vallatieri certainly has instant hostility. I remember Jim Lehrer saying, you know, it would be very good for every junior to experience having a jolt from Nick. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's where Austin didn't mess up that much. I remember being at the Eddie Herwin time, and Donald Young, he was working with Nick, and Nick at that time was in his 70s, up in his crow's nest, you know, where you climb up and you can look all over the courts. And, you know, Donald Young, he hits a racket and drops the F-bomb. And Nick came down those stairs, I should say the ladder to the crow's desk. And it was like a scene from the Twilight Zone. Nobody was moving. The umpires were still, the players were still, every court stopped. Mm-hmm. And this is during the Eddie Herr, and Nick goes out on the court and he takes his finger and he says, right in Donald Young's chest, young man, you will not do that. But coming back to Steve, Arthur Ashe, John McEnroe wrote a book. So his first book, what is it? You Can't Be Serious. So I read the book and I called Denton up and I go, Denton, you made McEnroe's book. They used, as you know, they called him the Bull. And he had, it was a Davis Cup session. Arthur Ashe is a captain, and McEnroe, Steve Denton's got McEnroe by the neck, and he's about to put McEnroe's head in the toilet. And Arthur Ashe says, "Bull, bull, bull! Please don't do that." But I coming to talk about being new, too nice. I remember there was a senior when Austin was a freshman, had a real attitude problem, and they had me working with him just a little bit. I as you know, Texas A&M, they were looking at one point before the economy fell apart in 2007, 2008 to have a learning center within a new indoor tennis complex. And I was flattered that they wanted to have me come and run this learning center. So, but Denton, you know, he eventually got mad at the senior. Actually, Austin stepped up eventually and had words with the senior, which was not typical of Austin. But Denton grabbed this kid, and this kid's like, oh, your son, you know, he's 6'2", 6'3", big kid. Denton grabs him by one hand. He hangs him up on one of those hooks. You know, the kid's wearing a hoodie. But I do think that was one thing, that Austin, he just needed to go forward more. You know, I mean, I know that his going into his junior year, you mentioned the Russian teammate, Griggy. I was at the NCAAs, and the Russian guy who was sent to me because I did some work for Roddick Tennis Academy, and he was there, and he didn't make any changes in his game. He came right up to me. He goes, "Coach, I should have changed my game." And he was working with Steve as a volunteer assistant because he was trying to finish his degree. But he talked about how Austin went forward so much that one point. Let me say this about stats. Austin was staying at our place we call it tennis house in Tampa. We have one now in Orlando. And young kid who did quite well in the 12s, 14s, Victor Lilov. He's still playing. He's 15 or 16. And his sister's a scholar, and she was just learning tennis, and she was helping her brother, but she was charting matches for Austin. And Andy and I were last night, we were watching. It's amazing. You just push a few buttons on the computer, and you watch matches from all over the world. But Austin, he was a pro, and I remember him playing Sam Groth and Smicek and, you know, two different players, but Austin serving and Groth is at the net. But yeah, I think that's very, very important for the parents to hear, is to be managed by stats.
Absolutely. So that there's something that I like to kind of say, that this is kind of me. There's what I call, there's four kind of I don't knows. And I truly, truly believe this. And you can relate this to tennis coaches. You can relate this to business people. You can relate this to tennis players, presidents, senators. You can relate it to anything. But there are four kind of people regarding what they know and they don't know. The first type of person is some people just don't know. Some people, the second people don't know that they don't know. The third people, they know they don't know. That's me. And most, you know, good parents and what have you. But the most dangerous person, this is what you really want to look out for and keep stay away from. The most dangerous is, especially in the tennis industry, is somebody who thinks they know, but they really don't know. That's the guy who's got the, or gal that's got the basket of balls in the trunk of a car, and they get their tennis certification to teach on a weekend or something like that, and they don't know. So if there was one thing that I would have changed also is, you know, it's much easier to learn. The very first thing that I said, there's no substitute for a good beginning. That's Steve's line. I give him credit for that, of course. But if there's one thing that I would do, if I knew then what I know now, I would have found Steve or somebody that Steve's trained or somebody like Steve that earlier. You can unlearn, but it's much harder to unlearn and then relearn. If you've got great base, it's much easier to, you know, continue with that. And Austin hasn't been to Steve for a while, but he you know, talked to Steve, you know, once a year, if you will, and videos and things. And quite honestly, I was talking to him about he and his partner possibly being videoed. You never see yourself. You kind of can now. You see a match, but you really don't see what you're working on, what you're training on. But video doesn't lie. Video doesn't lie.
With video, time goes by fast. But with so you'd asked me to circle back, and I was working with Austin. And listeners should know that Rob certainly knows more about the great base, and we can talk about some of the things that we've done. I've got this in my notes as far as American tennis and tennis business and such. But so Austin is spending so much time at Saddlebrook. And here are some things about being too nice. I go, Austin, take this poll. You're going to go out. You're playing Isner this morning or this afternoon. Just put this camera up on the fence and then bring it back and we'll chart it. And he was just, you know, felt uncomfortable doing that because no one else was doing that.
That's not cool.
And I said, you know, bring it back. And, you know, this scholar, Radina, she's just dedicated. She's studying tennis, and she'll chart the match and show you how to chart. Another time during that period was I actually had to be at Saddlebrook because there were some coaches that were there from overseas and they wanted to meet with me. And I wasn't directly working, but I mean, it's obviously just 15 miles up the street. And so Austin was going to spend the day, and he's going to be filmed on the backhand, trying to just tweak it a little bit, filmed on the serve, tweak it a little bit. And I had a coach to go through it with him. But that's where Nisha Corey, who who's obviously done so well. I mean, I know I saw your son go three sets with him on a televised match. I believe they were roommates at Baltieri's. They spent so much time there. So Annie may have to edit this, but I said, Austin, you don't have to hit with Nisha Afagori. You've hit with him for years and years. You need to say no.
It just means flipping, right?
Yeah, freaking. But with another thing too, with being too humble, too shy. You know, I remember recommending to you were all for it. I said, Austin, you're going to go to Dallas and play. You're going to go to wherever and play. Why don't we work on a PowerPoint presentation and you can meet and because you know you even though he was not. Top 10 in the world and a marquee player, but what he accomplished in juniors, then he's an NCAA champion, all American, is to share his pathway, and parents would be so interested in doing that. Yeah. I mentioned Ashley Weinel earlier. She balked and thought that was a crazy idea, but because not many pros do that, but I think it's something to be in education, share his stories. I was with Austin at Indian Wells, and we just worked out. We spent an entire day with Raven Klassen. I think this would be interesting for the listeners. Raven was born in 82. Austin was born in 90. So when Austin was younger, there was times where he's a little kid. He's hitting, Raven was being nice and hitting with this little kid. But, they've been on the court playing matches where Raven told me that he's been – just beat pretty badly by Austin and his partner. But we spent the entire day, and Raven was advising Austin. And it's a great place to spend the day if you want to watch some tennis, have lunch, have dinner. And there was an off day for those two guys. But I remember Raven sharing advice that Eric Buterath had shared with him as far as, doing things for down the road. And from that conversation, I think it was one of the reasons that Raven – that Austin eventually was on the ATP Pro Council in some capacity, correct?
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
What Raven had told at that tournament, I remember Austin coming. I was not there. You were, Steve. Raven was trying to keep Austin from committing to be 100% doubles at that time. Austin was contemplating that. We all thought and maybe even knew that Austin would make the majority of his money playing doubles. He's just a good doubles player. He's got great hands and what have you. And Raven kind of set a time frame. And Austin was probably at the time 22 or 3 or something like that. And he said, give it to age 26. When you're going to be 27, 20, 26, 27, then you make a decision. And thank goodness he didn't, because Austin went from where he was in singles to 94. Mm-hmm. Now, 94 doesn't sound really that high, and maybe it's not in today's terms, or in yesteryear's terms, when Denton and Bobby and all those guys played. But 94 now, you got to be a pretty decent player. So he got to be 94. He's been as high as 35, but he did wait. He took Raven's advice, if you will, and then committed to doubles at age 27. And just for the fact, and if Raven listens to this, whatever else he knows it. He's played Raven 3 times, and Raven just say Austin kicked my butt, or he and his partner kicked my butt all 3 times. So, yeah, we've kind of, I think, both in the back of Steve's mind and my mind, maybe not back of Austin's mind also, it would be a good pairing to have Raven and Austin play righty lefty, experienced under Steve and experienced under Steve the other. So that may happen some one day. Who knows?
Well, I was just thinking, Raven Austin is 30. You just mentioned David Squire. I mean, his son is 6'5". He was on the team last year at Wake Forest. I don't know what he's going to do now with the pandemic. Don't know what anyone's going to do. But, you just never know when it comes down to partners. But Matt Clore, who was out here just the other day, and he's somebody that we sent your son to you're driving to the tournament in Virginia. Why don't you stop in North Carolina? You can stay there and stay there and practice. But now at age 30, here's the way it's gone with people taking care of their bodies. Hopefully Austin can be playing and making money for the next 10 years.
Well, big change. I'm sorry, Andy, didn't mean to step on you. I think, you know, you didn't ask the question, but I will say this, that it used to be, I think, can't think of his name, just escaped me, Bjorn Borg. He retired when he's 26. Yeah. At 26. Mm-hmm. Now the Bryan twins just retired, and I'm not sure, they were 42, 43, maybe 44, or whatever else. And everybody says, well, why are the people playing so long? And why, how can Fed play when he's 37, 38 years old? I think the biggest change is prehab versus rehab. Mm. So what you do is, I mean, just the equipment, the training, the stretching, the nutrition, what you eat and so forth is so important now. And the rackets, the strings that guys are using, were back in the day, I mean, you know, you get hurt and then you take, you know, 2 months or 6 months to recover. So knock on wood, Austin has yet to have a quote serious injury. And I hope to God that he never does. But the prehab is a big thing.
Yeah. Yeah, but he's at with his experience now. I mean, you know, he's the one who could be mentoring a young player.
There's a point there, Steve. You know, it's a good point. I just wanted to say while I'm thinking about it, or I'll forget, getting old. You never think that your kid or your player is listening to you, Steve, or to me. I mean, you know, they don't roll their eyes. Certainly they look you in the eye, and we taught him that. And that's one of the things we're proud of him. When he meets somebody, shakes the hands, you know, when it's not COVID, looks you in the eye and, hi, I'm Austin Krajicek. He'll introduce himself and what have you. But you never think that you're never really sure, are they listening to you or not? Well, Austin, here, since he's been doing, you know, pretty well, and he's got a courtesy, country club membership and what have you. So in order for him to do that, he has to hit with the mature guys and then have a hit with some of the juniors occasionally when he's in town and whatever else. But it's amazing the stuff that he tells them. And Sherry and I go like, my gosh, he was listening. I mean, he's using the same terminology. When I'm making a percentage post, this is a green light point. This is a red light point. You know, this is a yellow light point. So it's just the different things, you know, the court is 3 feet short of being, twice as long as it is wide. I mean, he just, it's ingrained in his brain and in mine.
So, it's interesting. There's a video, not too long, I guess it's probably some years back, but it was, you mentioned Victor Lilov and then Austin, they were both together. I put it up some months ago, but you know, they were demonstrating strokes and mirroring each other. And it was like, he could just demonstrate perfectly everything, you know?
No, I can remember, you know, Victor Lilov's parents, like you and Sherry, they've done so much for their son to become a great tennis player, all the sacrifices. So what's very, very good for kids when they're 9, 10 years old is to play what I call the mushrooms. You know, the guy wears the big floppy hat and he's got the pop belly and he's got the band on his elbow. And but I can remember with Austin, you know, watching, you know, Victor and a few other kids. You know, so I've got, you know, four kids playing, and I got four, they're playing singles too. They're, and you know, it's the 9, 10 year old playing the mushroom. Let's circle back one thing on college tennis. I think there's so many podcasts. I was listening to David Schilling, who now is at Denison, and he was at Ohio State. It's called Cracked Rackets. Just so many interviews, but the college tennis, Austin, with family, you know, I mean, there was some tragedies where, not to mention names, but one player's father committed suicide, and then his doubles partner tragically lost his life. You know, I just think that it's amazing the experiences that one has when you go to college. You don't really have a lost weekend. It's almost like you have this extended family. The coaches know what you're doing. They know if you have an exam. And could you just say a few things about like the family atmosphere, Steve Denton?
Absolutely. I highly, highly encourage college tennis. At first, like a Jesse Levine who went for 6 months, and I think a Maradelic went for 6 months or a year or something for Craig. Yeah. We thought that Austin may go for 6 months and have that experience and whatever. He went for 4 years, and we're so glad he did. And he's so glad he did. He'll tell you, if you ask him himself, maybe you could interview him, you know, later at a later time.
Yeah, you could do that. Yeah.
And yeah. But I think college tennis is so good. The team atmosphere, again, you know, when you clinch a match and the camaraderie and the warming up and the travel and the working out and things like that. Yeah, it is. When somebody's hurt or sick, you know, everybody's concerned. But when somebody loses their life, and there's been a couple tragedies at Austin's young life that he has experienced, then it's tragic. But life goes on. And, you just do the best that you can do. There's not too much you can say about that.
Was there any times during his collegiate career that he thought, hey, maybe I'll turn pro after this year? Or was that ever a discussion?
I think after his first year, he loved it so much he was in. Yeah. He was all in. And I tell you what, his mother, I may have already said this, and I apologize for repeating, but I think it's good, even if I do. The people at tennis and at college, there are friends and parents and players and what have you. Don't wish away. Don't, you know, if you, I did this and if I, and I did that, enjoy every day. Mm. And again, going back to what Nick Butler said, play it like it's the last match you're ever going to play. Enjoy it because it goes so fast. Yeah, we could not believe how fast college tennis went. We came out here in our RV and thinking we would stay for a couple weeks or a month. We stayed 5 years and we couldn't wait to the next season because, you know, he's going to be better. And he did, he got better and better and better, but don't wish your life away. Enjoy, every day to its fullest. And especially now with this COVID thing, whatever else, I mean, it's a learning lesson for all of us.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a couple of players. I have to look up Jesse Levine. Pretty sure Amir Dalek played 3 years for Illinois, but someone who Austin's won titles with, Rajiv Ram, I listened to him on an interview, and he only was at Illinois for one semester. But
maybe it was Raj that was only at Illinois, not Amir Dalek, sorry.
But what Rajiv Ram said in that interview was, if he knew back then at age 18, 19, that, you know, he could be playing, you know, well into his mid-30s or later, that he, you know, if he could turn the clock back, he would have stayed in college tennis a little bit longer.
Good save.
I'm sitting right next to this big microphone. And just gave it the elbow. Or maybe it gave me the
old hockey elbow coming back in you.
Woke everybody up, Steve.
With senior moment. Do you have any of those senior moments, Krychek?
No, never.
Good answer.
All the time.
with tennis business, when I first met you, you had already met all these pros. We touched upon that at the beginning when you went around to all the coaches in St. Pete, Tampa, Clearwater. And I was just so impressed with your organizational skills. I remember we talked about, you know, not that you would get on the court, but if you, we could try to help out and try to develop several, you know, tennis clinics, junior development programs around greater Tampa. That was one thing. Another was the backboard. Andrew Garcia spent some time on that. And that's what I mean is that Rob has really been an insider to what we do. And he knows, like, for example, would be the importance of having really good junior development programs in any city. Because Rob and I, we could just go back to, Austin from 1990 and my two sons, one born in 89, one born in 1990. All the kids you meet, that really the light at the end of the tunnel is a train coming right at them because they have such a poor technical base. But the backboard business that we now, just a side note, one of our coaches is really done a great job. It's called the all-in-one backboard, and now it has multiple functions. So we've progressed slowly, but we haven't lost the dream of trying to, you know, have every kid. And that's our mission with the Great Base, you know, free content is give kids good information and then ways where they can understand basics and then repeat. But I'd like to touch upon this story with you read where Craig Tiley, like Thomas Olish did, he went to the program in Tyler, Texas. And then he ended up staying for a long time. And it had to do with his visa, and he continued and not only got the 2-year degree, but stayed and ended up getting a master's degree at nearby University of Texas at Tyler. So you had read where he said, when he went to Australia to be the CEO, first he was the director of player development, that he said it would take him 10 years to develop a network. So you contacted Paul Rodert, and at that time, Ashley Weinold, who was mentioned earlier, and your son, they were being used for some illustrations or some photos. And Paul Rodert, he was a gopher for Gideon Aero, biomechanist, when I was a gopher for Vic Braden. A gopher is go for this, go for that. Go get the pencil, Steve. go get some duct tape, Steve. And but you know, he's a biomechanist. So and then he was with the USDA, and then he went to Illinois, and he worked for Human Kinetics, which is based in Champaign. And they have done many things with books and videos mm-hmm. for different sports education. So you made it possible where all of a sudden you and I are in the room with the USTA. And at that time, you know, Paul Lubbers and Ann Pankhurst were there. That was like his number two, number three person. But I went with all the videos, and you know, we had the film of young Pete Sampras hitting a forehand ground stroke, forehand approach shot, mm-hmm. forehand volley, backhand volley, overhead. And we had all sorts of film. But we spent many, many hours initially with Paul. And our idea was, we have a network of coaches and we would want to help out the USTA, the governing body of tennis. And I said I didn't think that we should go through the national coaches. I thought, well, there's too much ego in the room. A lot of former players and like, who's this guy? Who's this trench bro who teaches little kids how to play, talking to us? But I said, you know, if we could approach working with young kids. But anyway, what happened was, never forget where Ann Pankhurst, who's done a lot, had done a lot of things with the British Tennis Association Federation, and at that time, just like Austin, my two kids could play a little bit, and she said, "Is that your son?" And I hesitated, and I let her ask a second time, "Is that your son?" And she said, "You're not testing him on a full court, are you?" And this was, and there was a big push to have a 36-foot court and a 60-foot court. And I said, "Oh no, it's Pete Sampras." And but what happened was at that time, you know, Paul was very gracious, and it's not like Paul Lubbers anything was really done wrong, but you know, I remember he had Paul Rodert had Paul Lubbers call me up, and so apologized to the two of us because you know they really were threatened by what we were saying. But I remember Paul Rodert saying, because I was saying things like grip on three, grip on four, and I was using what we consider to be Vic Braden language, lingo. And Paul Lubbers and Ann Pankhurst didn't know that lingo, but Paul Rodert did because he had been a gopher for Gideon Aero as a partner of Vic Braden's. But he knew the connection because, to a certain degree, knew it because he left the USTA and he went to Illinois. And he went to Illinois. First, it was Jennifer Roberts, who we trained, and then it was Craig Tiley, who we trained, and they were the coaches at Illinois. And, you know, then it was, you know, Ashley Weinold and your son were both among the best juniors in the country. So the timing was right. Plus, Tiley had said in this interview that it would take him 10 years to develop a network. Anyway, Paul left the USTA, and a lot of things have happened since he left. I mean, Arthur Ashe now has a roof over it, and they have a beautiful park in Orlando, 5 miles from where we're living, that has 100 tennis courts. I don't know how much they've done with certification and education, a lot of effort, but if you remember what Paul said is that, I can understand the politics of it. He said that if they were involved with our curriculum, the Great Base, is that it would be in conflict of the PTR and the USPTA. But now that the tables have turned where the USTA is now accrediting the PTR and the USPTA. But I think what needs to happen with education is we need to have people like your son and people like Raven Claussen. You know, I would say the CEO of a company, I think that these top players, if they just were to understand fundamentals and how little kids are taught, but Andy, well, we have another couple of questions for Rob. Rob, you have any thoughts from that experience way back when, though, going back to the UTA?
I do. And there's not many times that I get angry, whatever else. And I did not get angry or blow up or whatever else. But after meeting with those guys, and I actually said it to them, and I remember to this day, Steve's eyeballs rolling around in his head. Everybody in the room except Steve and I were PhDs, every one of them. And I kind of referred to that and what have you. And I said, you know, if it wasn't piled so high and deep, PhD, and you should have seen them. And they didn't take a disrespect because I kind of apologized before I even said it. I said, you know, maybe we get something done. And I felt at that time, and I still feel now. And the reason we were there, I think, is when Patrick McEnroe, before Patrick McEnroe was hired,
He came in right around the same time, but we had the meeting before he was hired.
Exactly. And my thought process is that the reason we're there is because I felt and feel that Steve would be the perfect player development national person. He already has a network of 500 or 1,000 or 1,500. I don't know how many coaches you have, Steve, in the United States. You wouldn't have to build, you know, new facilities and things like that. And everybody's trained the same way. And I thought, and I still think it's a great idea, but they didn't think, because, you know, all the excuses and all the reasoning that they would say. And the USGA is very powerful and so much money, they waste so much money. I got a story to tell you here, and I won't mention any names, but there was a national junior coach when Austin was a national junior player, and they were playing in Tampa. We lived in Brandon, probably 15, 20 miles from there. And we went to a tournament at Harbor Island Tennis Club clay courts. And when we got there, this coach and four or five of the USGA juniors were coming across the street, and they had just went to Jackson's Landing or something, some really nice, fancy restaurant. And I mentioned, hey, coach, you know, I knew his name, know him well, and still know him now. I said, what are you guys doing? And he basically said, I'm teaching the guys how to be pros, how to be pro tennis players. By eating and paying for it with their American Express card. That's what he meant. I couldn't believe it. And to this day, I still rag on him to, you know, why and what. But, you know, I mean, there's difficulties and things with all businesses, and USGA is a business. And yeah.
Maybe if you're ranked top 10 in the world.
When it comes down to it, you got to have a little bit of sense of humor. I think the PhD piled higher and deeper. No, they definitely have to get trench pros involved.
Yeah.
Talking about macaroni and cheese piled higher and deeper, right?
That's good. Last night, Andy and I, just for a few minutes, we were watching these players that we've worked with in one capacity or another. And I've worked as a supplemental coach with Patrick Gibson. You know, he worked with Matt Clore, Chris Clore. He did so many things with the USPTA, and I used to call him appetizer, because when you, you know, my son spent some time with USGA coaches, great people, but it's funny money. I think now perhaps with the coronavirus, maybe there won't be so much money to spend. But Craig Morris, who I haven't met, he now is high up in the USTA, and I think he's really, you know, when it comes to the forehands and backhands, I think he's the right-hand man of the new CEO, Michael Dowse. I haven't met him either, but because we're their neighbors, someone just insisted that I send the new CEO an email, invite him out to our place. But they want to, the USTA, they've come forward and said they want to certify 30,000 people. And I think if they're going to do that, what they need to do is they need to certify parents to be able to teach basics, you know, make it very simple. You know, go back to the Welby Van Horn body balance positions, everything that we did with Austin, we have it all documented on film. You know, Austin, we have people that have similar results in juniors, and maybe less for sure, similar results in college, and even less in pros, obviously. That's just how it works. You know, less than 3% of junior players play college tennis. But if they were to certify parents, and then there was, if there was peer teaching, you know, when it comes down to, you know, you've seen us do it so many times, Rob, is that we actually will get a 10-year-old to not only teach an 8-year-old, we'll get a 10-year-old to teach a 14-year-old just because teaching is information transfer.
Right.
But that's, yeah, the whole breakdown of the education system, we'll have to go through that. But I have a brother who has a PhD, and you certainly have to go through a lot of bells and hoops, but when it really comes right down to it, you have to connect the trench pros. You know, you can't really improve tennis teaching by having discussions in the boardroom. Let's wrap it up though with Austin in the Olympics. He's probably like 2 or 3. I mean, I would think Rahm and Austin are up there. I didn't look at the American rankings for doubles.
Well, Rahm is 1, Austin's 2, because Mike and Bob have retired.
Yeah.
They're still above Austin, but they're going down a spot or two every week or whatever else. But Austin, of active players, it's so difficult. It's so difficult being an American player playing the Davis Cup or the Olympics. I'm not saying it's fair, unfair, whatever else, but there are so many good players, kind of. Now it's kind of like there's not so many, but there's kind of waves, what have you, but it's very tough to get in. But it's kind of like, you know, and I don't want to mention names, whatever else, but like Jack Sock. Jack Sock is Jack Sock. I mean, he's got, you know, a great big serve, a great big forehand, and all the confidence in the world. There's a lot of people that don't particularly care for his style or his attitude or whatever else. But even though he's, you know, ranked lower or whatever else, it's going to be very difficult, I think, for Austin to play either the Davis Cup or the Olympics, not just because of Jack Sock, but because of that type of mentality, if you will. So I don't even know how they pick them. If it's the number one and number two player and they go automatically, and then the third and the fourth, I don't know. But if, you know, if there's anything to be said like that, it's you know, it makes it tough. It's political. Political.
Well, I think just being ready when opportunity and preparation meet, you know, I mean, I think the Mike and Bob, it took them a while to get in the door. And then once they were and they delivered, it was like, okay, you can do it.
If I would have married a non-American person, Steve was married at one time to an Irish lady. And one time they were teasingly, he says, you know, Connor McHale could possibly play Davis Cup for them because she's whatever. I mean, and it's kind of crazy, but that's almost what you have to do. Canadians, I think Rozinski went from Canada to England or England to Canada or something so he could play way back.
Oh, no, there's so many stories. Marty Mulligan is Australian, and he became Marty Mulligino, and he was an Aussie. He did well on the dirt courts on the red clay with 5 sets with Laver. One of the years at Laver, I think it was 69, not 62, where Laver won the Grand Slam. No, my son Connor from Connor Nyland, he had the invite, and I would have liked to see him do it, but I said, it's your choice, Connor. But he was ranked high enough at 200 in the world where at that time he would have been a playing member of the Irish Davis Cup team. But, you know, they get to a certain age, as you and Sherry have done so well with, it was not my decision at that time. I said, if I had a vote, I would say I would go play for Ireland. The McEnroe family, John obviously was a Davis Cup star, but Patrick, he went over and he played the Irish junior championships, and he won. They played on, at that time, a place called Fitzwilliams. It was on regular grass. Connor went over and he played the 18s. He lost in the final, but they play on artificial grass. And actually in Ireland, when it rains, they don't stop playing. Regardless, even if he had won that junior Irish championships, the reason that he was invited is that he had a high, respectable or a higher ranking than at that time other Irish players. Even the Bryan brothers, it took them, it was many years. Chris Woodruff from the University of Tennessee, who's an excellent player. He played Davis Cup and he played doubles before the Bryans were asked to, and that was not his forte. The Bryan brothers, they had to wait quite some time. They were worthy of playing long before they were asked to play.
Yeah.
Right. Well, if you look at it from this point of view, and I'm not saying this is what Austin, he's waiting until people retire or whatever, but he's 30. Again, that's still, you know, kind of in your prime and what have you. And the Bryans just retired at 43. Yeah. If Austin continues to play and continues to stay healthy, which we hope and pray that, you know, that happens, is that if he won one Grand Slam a year, that's 10 Grand Slams. If you win two on a year, or, you know, or whatever, I mean, it could happen. Mm-hmm. So again, you go back to somebody's got to be number one.
Yeah.
Why not you? And will it happen? I don't know. Time will tell. And Austin, it's up to Austin and his partner. But you just never know.
One thing with Austin, and it's a compliment, is that, you know, he's a lifer. He just loves it. With my son Connor would be upset with me on this. He stayed at the same apartment in Germany, David Squire's apartment. And you know, I remember, you know, Connor going, "It's such a small apartment." Of course, then I give him the gears like a dad. I go, "It doesn't matter that it's a small apartment."
Right.
But that's where, you know, Austin, as a lifer, is you just know some people, there's not many, that he's just not going to go away. The passion is so strong. If you were to, you and Sherry were to be asked, you know, so hopefully, knock on wood, he's healthy, he plays for 10 more years. I see him having a career after a playing career. Would you see him being in tennis business, or you know, a junior coach, college coach, pro coach? What would you, if you had to guess?
Well, guess? Austin's degree will be in December in psychology. Now, what can you do with a psychology degree? You got to have your master's, your PhD to really do anything with it. Yeah. But you know, there's some psychologists and Alan Fox and those guys, like you know, really good guys that mean, you know, to the ATP and the tennis world or something like that. That's kind of what we thought it would be at A&M. You know, he's you know, a Hall of Famer there. And as a matter of fact, just coincidentally, this past week I was on a Zoom call with the Alumni Association and all the Letterman Association. He has been inducted, although he hasn't accepted it yet, and the ceremony hasn't happened. They're waiting till next fall, September 17th is Friday. There'll be a big dinner to do. And then Saturday, they'll be at a game. They want to announce it in front of 105,000 instead of 12,000.
That's great.
So he has been inducted. So we're really proud of that. One other thing that was really, really cool. I just want to get this in here. Two things that really stand out in this college, I mean, that bring tears to my eyes, and usually I literally bring tears to my eyes. Two things that that happened. His last match of his last of his tennis career, home, you know, before the tournament, before he won the NCAA, he was there playing Texas, and he clinched the match, and there was a standing ovation for him. That really touched me. And the second thing is, after the matches, we'd always go to this place called Boston's and have a beer or two and some pizza, and the adults would go one side and the players would go the other side and so forth. And they kind of called us over. This is a senior year. And they changed the name of the most valuable trophy from, you know, Texas A&M most valuable trophy to the Austin Krychek most valuable trophy.
Wow. That's
cool. And they changed it. It's kind of like the Heisman trophy. And I mean, that's really touching, and they still do that. So, and I kind of, I mentioned that to Steve, said, "No, we still do that. I told you we would." And we have a plaque in the house, and that, I just look at it. It's like, wow. We're really proud of him. We're really proud of him. Will he ever get the number one? Who knows? It's up to Austin. What he does is up to him. We're very proud of him. If he stopped tomorrow, you know, or today, that's okay. He'll do whatever he wants to do. But Dennis has basically said it'll be an open invitation when he leaves, that it's very likely he could be, if he wanted to be, because of his claims and so forth, at Texas A&M, to be the head coach of Texas A&M. But, you know, it kind of just depends. Will he want to be in tennis for his whole life? I think so.
Yeah.
He just knows too much.
Yeah.
I think he'll be in tennis the rest of his life in one capacity or another.
Yeah. So many things. Wasn't Austin's first match against Ohio State, and it was 3-3, he was the last match out.
Yes.
Because, you know, I tell kids that all the time. So, as you know, I grind kids and I'm pushing them. And we watched two girls in the 14s play this afternoon. And, you know, the way one behaved, and it's usually the other one who doesn't behave very well. And it was like, whoa, girls. And, you know, it's just because, you know, who's going to win for the day? And they just don't really understand. Right. They don't understand competition at all. You know, they're just neophytes or young kids. Especially if it's at a tournament and if your team wins, you move on. Mm. You know, I know my son Connor, he had the chance to close many, many times. But you're out there, it's 3-all. And I think the parents just need to understand this. So there's soft love, tough love, and crazy love. And to prepare somebody for that, I think there's so much pressure in that situation. I mean, there's pressure, one, just to make the lineup. You know, it's not like mom and dad. At the local level, mom and dad just write a tournament and you take your kid to the tournament. But to actually to get into the school, to make the team, you know, once you get to college, and, you know, that this is something where Austin's the coach's dream. As I tell this to parents, that you would never tell a college coach that you just want to play college tennis, because a lot of kids get there and they're just on welfare because, okay, I'm here, I'm on the college team, but it's making the lineup. And then it's, you know, some kids don't even make the travel squad. So eight people go on spring break, and number 9 and 10, 11 and 12, they stay home. But
talking college tennis, you know, there's so many international players anymore. And there have been for quite a while. And a lot of parents really don't like that. And I understand why they don't like that. But kind of going back to one of the things I said earlier is that, and I've read it and heard it, and I've heard Steve say it before also, the reason there's so many international players is because the coach only sees the parents one time a year. They don't have to, you know, deal with the parents, you know, well, I think my son should be starting or playing, you know, up a line or something like that. They don't have to deal with that. Where in American, we're so, you know, country clubized and we think that we earn it and deserve it and whatever else. And you got to earn it. Mm-hmm. So that's one of my things, that the reasons that I think there's so many international players, they're good for, first of all, and like I said, if you don't make it, you go home, pound salt.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What if you were to give one piece of advice for, I mean, you and Sherry were athletes, so you understood a little bit about what it takes to raise an athlete, to be an athlete. But if you were to talk to parents out there that weren't athletes or aren't really athletes and their kid loves tennis, what advice would you give them? Maybe one or two pieces.
Well, again, what I basically said is you have to have a player that wants it, that has the potential. Find a good coach. Or a good organization that you can trust, not somebody who's, like I said, working out of their trunk, what have you, that understands, has the best interest, and then let the coach do his job. Yeah. That's what I'd say. The goal should be, I mean, sure, I planted a seed way back when Austin was 10 years old. You know, somebody's going to be number one. Why not you?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you just kind of say that. You're just being positive. Is that ever going to happen? The goal, in my opinion, should be college tennis. You know, if you can get your college education paid for somewhat or all, and get an education. And then let's see what happens after that. So that would be my suggestion.
Jimmy Rogers, a Canadian, I'm sure your son, you as well, have met Jim Rogers over the years, but I love how he says it is college tennis is the goal. Pro tennis is the dream.
That's right.
Hey, let me this. Here's the wrong way to make a statement. Behind every successful man is a successful woman. But this is really the right way to say it. Behind every successful man is a surprised mother-in-law. but I tease and I say, okay, you know, we would really enjoy talking to you. I'm sure our listeners got a lot out of it, but I would have to say that it would have been a lot better if we could have talked to Sherry instead of you. You know, I asked you to ask Sherry, you mentioned about earlier, is enjoy it. Any other thoughts from your partner, life partner, on bringing up a tennis kid?
That's pretty much, I ask her point blank, and those are the things that she actually came up with. And don't be fooled. You say, well, there's organizers and managing, and then there's the one who kind of whatever. Sherry wears the pants. I mean, Sherry makes the decision. I mean, happy wife, happy life. You know, you've heard that before. We work together. We try to, I mean, you know, do we disagree sometimes? Sure. But we always have, you know, each other's best interest at heart. And of course, our son, he's our only son, his best interest, and we do whatever. And that's another story, but that's why we're living in Texas now, not in Florida. We're here for our son.
Yeah. Well, Rob, I'm honored that you and Sherry have listened to me, taken some advice. I tell this story, but, you know, Krychek met with me, and I know that you had had motorhomes before, but you met with me and asked me about buying a motorhome, and I said, bad idea, your kid's going to be too good. So next time I saw you, you had a big motorhome. So you didn't listen to everything I said, that's for sure.
Not everything, Steve.
Anyway, it's been great to talk to you. Yeah.
I'm honored to be on the call, and I hopefully that, you know, I said something that may mean something to another tennis parent. That's what we want to do. Yeah. Andy, I haven't had the pleasure of getting to know you as well as I know Steve, but I know that you've been a blessing to him, computer wise and cell phone.
Oh, that list goes on and on and on. We don't have time.
Oh my! Right, but it takes two to tango, and glad that you and your wife are there and helping out. And but I appreciate everything, yeah. And we got a lot of tennis to be played, Jeff.
Yeah. With my former wife, how's it go? We had a strange and wonderful relationship. She was strange and I was wonderful. But no, I know that you and my former wife, the nickname we called her Irish, you guys had lots of laughs. And
sure.
But when it comes down to, in some ways, for the parents listening, with Sherry, my former wife, and you, it seems like it was yesterday. 1990 was a long time ago. I mean, for your son,
time flies.
30 years, and but you know, and not every day. You know that. I mean, I can just I could go. The parents should know. With say Rob and Sherry, we could go to one of these beautiful parks in Orlando, and it could be Court 12, and I could tell a story about Court 12. You know, just like, okay, I remember you playing this kid, and I think most junior players, when you ask them, as they get to the level that your sons that were playing pro tennis, is they look back and there was too much emphasis on winning, too much stress, and they just didn't worry about getting better. Mm. You know, now this didn't exist when Austin was a kid, but they have the UTR. And there's lots of positives with the UTR. In other words, trying to get kids where they don't have to travel all over the country. They can play more matches in their backyard and have tennis be less expensive. But no, I think that one thing with the parents, you and Sherry just understood the long road, you know, long-term vision, and, you know, not to get your knickers in a twist when you're playing the 10s and 12s. But
totally agree.
But no, I appreciate you joining us, and, you know, hopefully we can get together in different ways, and we'll down the road talk to Austin, and and I know you support our mission is you know, tennis teachers need to know how to teach a great base, and, you know, kids need to have a great base that works in every form of education. And our thing is not ego driven. It's really, there's a lot of homework, and it's based on all these different coaches over the years. And, it's been great to talk to you, but thanks so much.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thanks.
Enjoy. It. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank
all right,
Steve.
Rob,
thank
all
you,
the
Andy.
Best. All right.
See you.
Sounds good.
All the best to you. Bye.
Bye.
That was great.
Yeah.
Great conversation.
Yeah. Lots of energy. Yeah, they did a great. They have done. They continue to. I mean, obviously, Austin's not a kid anymore, but it's great to reflect back. And you know, the one thing, we go up to our library and we can dig out some old video. And yeah. He had the little kid grip. You know, he had not only a Western grip, but wrist underneath and the elbow pointing down, and where the racket almost hits your earlobe.
Yeah,
you know, you're on your back foot, and you're swinging way open, and you know, people don't need to judge the unfinished product. So when people watch what we're doing, it looks so mechanical and so robot-like. And
yeah.
But he did the hard yards. You know, so basically, his work with us, we would label that as a pre-academy. Mm-hmm. So then he got a chance to go to a place like Nick Baltieri's. Most academies are run on emotion, and competition and hard work, and that's what you need. But
yeah,
we need more first base coaches in tennis.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say everyone, but it seems like everyone wants to be a third base coach. And the parents make a mistake. We all make mistakes, but the consumer doesn't have consumer knowledge. The parents are blindly writing checks. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times the coach doesn't have product knowledge, but the parents think they're taking a shortcut because they're taking hitting lessons from someone who can hit the ball a little bit better.
Yeah.
But no, Rob, he certainly, he spent so much time not only with our tennis school in Tampa, but, you know, his son got to meet so many people that we've trained in these small towns around the country or bigger cities around the world.
Yeah.
But no, that's our mission. And I think it's great to hear someone like Rob Krajicek. He was part of it and it served them well.
Yeah, no, I think as well as what he was saying is, you know, he could circle back. So, I mean, although he's 30 years old, he had a lot of success in tennis. He could still circle back. And even when you're a pro, it's not like you just, okay, forget about these basics. You got to just keep working on those basics and keep improving.
Oh, especially on the tactical side. At every level of the game, it's the little things that turn into big things.
Yeah.
You know, like say someone's taught they're a right-handed player and they've been taught a severe continental grip on the forehand volley and they have their elbow in against their body and they're going to poach. And, you know, they're going to poach from the left side to the right side of the court and they want to hit the opposing net person in the right hip. Well, the racket face is facing the wrong way.
Yeah.
And you just see kids making this position. And it really does come down to it that in a lot of ways, you're an imposter. If you say, well, I'm just a tactical coach. If you don't know technique, you really don't know tactics.
Yeah.
You know, like say someone like Federer, everyone talks about Roger Federer, such a class act, but he has options. And, you know, and it's unfortunate that people are looking at, you know, say Roger at the end of the rainbow or he's got the pot of gold.
Right.
But, you know, what did he do? And that's documented. It's in one of the books we have upstairs is the quote from Lynette Federer. It's like, no, let's slow down and let's do this right.
That's why I was joking around earlier in this podcast episode about, I think Roger was taught, you know, lag and snap and pull and roll. Some of the things that are said today on the forehand, it's like there's no way
he was
taught that. But maybe we'll talk about the volley next week.
Yeah, we can talk about the volley. Let's go.
All right.
It's becoming a lost art.
It really is.
It's a ball that you hit in the air.
Well, we appreciate everybody for listening. Hopefully you got a lot out of that. I'm sure you did, especially parents listening, but also coaches and players. A lot you can take from that, a lot of insights. And we'll see you next week. This is Andy Fitzell signing off. You can find us on social media at Great Base Tennis and also visit our website at greatbasetennis.com.
All right. Thanks for the listening, the chit chat.
Okay. Adios, amigos.